On this week's 51%, is the fertility cliff a myth?
Globally, fertility decline over 35 is an absolutely accepted position.
And we hear from a nurse who has developed a unique training program to screen patients who are victims of partner violence. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Headlines are often full of advice for women about when they should have children. Marnie Chesterton goes digging into the fertility stats and myths for modern women.
As women have children later in life, there's a subject that can get a little sensitive.
I'm sure my mother said something.
I think it is that after 35, then it takes quite a steep drop. As soon as I got married, it was like, right, when are you starting?
People started piling on because you must have a baby before you're 40.
Many women have heard this kind of stuff, whether from eager grandparents, interfering friends, or well-meaning health professionals. And the papers don't help much.
Major study showed fertility falling off a cliff edge beyond the age of 35.
The female fertility clock starts ticking at 27.
Infertility time bomb. Infertility is set to double over the next decade in Europe.
I get this mental picture of the fertility cliff here as an actual cliff, like in the Roadrunner cartoons, where our fertility drops off suddenly to nothing. Although there's a very confusing mixture of headlines to pick from. The age at which you suddenly become barren seems to vary quite a lot. So who's right? What's this all based on and who collected the figures?
A good place to go digging is here, the Wellcome Institute in London. It's a huge neoclassical building on a busy London road, built to house the medical curiosities collected by Anglo-American captain of industry Sir Henry Wellcome.
It's also home to all sorts of medical collections and libraries packed full of journals. And here in the main library, I've dug out a science paper from 2004 by Henry Leridan. And here's a sample from the introduction. Maternal age is clearly an important factor in reproduction. In populations not using birth control, fertility rates decline when the mother is over 25. Rates decline especially when the mother is over 35. Now, the guy mentioned as the source of that information is another Henry, French biostatistician Louis Henry, who wrote a lot about fertility from a stats point of view in the 50s and 60s. Luckily, given that I don't speak French, there's an English translation of some of his papers here. And when you start digging around in his tables, you find his source data, which are the French birth and marriage records between 1670 and 1830.
Obviously, we would worry that those data wouldn't be relevant to modern times. Things might have changed quite a bit. These individuals being studied back then, they might not be at all of the same fertility as modern women.
That's David Dunson, an epidemiologist at Duke University in North Carolina. More from him in a bit. But first, in case this doesn't raise any alarm bells, let me give you some context. We've got a study from 2004 using research from the 1950s and 60s, which in turn uses records from the 17th and 18th century in France. Back in the 1700s, in that part of the world, you were doing above average if you survived to 30. This data set spans several wars, famine, the French Revolution. This is all before penicillin and even a theory about how germs spread disease. Surely, women's fertility rates back then were subject to all sorts of different pressures than women in 21st century developed countries with our antibiotics, vitamins and lack of plague.
Extreme poverty and diseases, etc., could actually lead to substantially reduced fertility. We don't know a lot about what exactly these different factors are doing to fertility, but we would be surprised if they didn't do anything.
Professor Dunson produced a paper in 2004 looking at how age affects fertility, but using modern couples trying for a baby who reported their progress to European family planning centres. Even this group presented problems for researchers.
If you just take women of different ages and look at the proportions who conceive, that could be extremely misleading. So if you look at somebody who's at risk being a kind of funny term, but at risk of pregnancy at, say, age 35, well, a lot of these women are still attempting conception because they've had some problems with their fertility. They're going to be somewhat selected for having lower fertility compared to just a general population of 35-year-old women.
In other words, if you're looking at a bunch of women in their mid to late 30s who are trying to get pregnant, you're not getting a normal selection of the population. Women who are highly fertile are more likely to have got pregnant already by their mid-30s and are therefore no longer in the same trying-to-get-pregnant group. And ethics dictates that you can't just force a random bunch of couples to have unprotected sex and see who has a baby and how long it takes them, even for science.
You're sort of stuck with relying on observational data in which you don't have really a representative sample. That's most of epidemiology is really like that.
David puts his finger on why this is such a challenging area to study. Female fertility varies so much, and you just can't tell where a woman is on the fertile spectrum by looking at her. And this is why birth and marriage records from 300 years ago, while not ideal, are a useful rough guess of how much female fertility changes with age. I don't know why Louis Henry's research from the 1950s picked such an old data set, but until recently, it was seen as good enough. David Dunson's study recorded stuff that no one did in the 18th century, like sex diaries. And does his study show a mid-30s fertility cliff?
No. I mean, I think you know the answer to that already, but for the vast majority of women, there's a slow decline in the probability of conception, and you don't have this kind of cliff phenomenon.
David's study found that 86% of women aged 27 to 34 could get pregnant within a year. For women a bit older, 35 to 39, that percentage fell, but only very little. 82% of couples could get pregnant within a year. But why does our fertility decline with age? Time to see the doctor.
My name is Yacoub Kelef. I'm a consultant.
Dr. Kelef is a consultant in reproductive medicine at Guy's Hospital in London.
Women are born with their endowment of eggs. They just don't make eggs during their reproductive life.
Our 40 years of reproductive life lasts from 15 to 55. And Dr. Kelef says that with every single period, we lose an egg. That's, by my calculations, about 480 over our lifetime. But we're born with a million, way more than we need. Most just disappear reabsorbed by our bodies. And the rest? Imagine them like a barrel of apples. By the time you've worked down to the ones at the bottom, they aren't the best.
It is a constant decline. The quantity is reduced, but the quality is also reduced because they have been there for much longer.
I noticed that you have a wall of babies behind you.
Yeah, that's what we live for. It all becomes worthwhile when we get that lovely and heartwarming letter or email saying, thank you very much.
So those babies on the board behind you, how old were their mothers?
This is two daughters. She was about 41.
Okay, so I'm 37. I don't have children yet.
Yeah.
Give me some encouragement. I shouldn't panic yet.
Oh, no, you shouldn't panic at all. There is no reason to panic at any stage as far as I'm concerned. But there is also good reason to always make that decision as soon as you are able to.
Professor Joyce Harper, an expert in women's health at University College London, offers me a less reassuring second opinion.
To be totally honest, you should be panicking. I know that's a hard fact to accept. There was an excellent paper that came out recently and basically said if you want three children, you need to start in your 20s.
The reason I have two differing opinions from two people who both know their stuff is that this area of medicine is still the realm of the statistician more than the biologist. They've both given me a course of action based on probability. I'll flip a coin and decide whether to panic later. One thing they can agree on, there's no such thing as the fertility cliff.
Globally, fertility decline over 35 is an absolutely accepted position.
But it's a slide, not a cliff.
Yeah, it's a slide.
That cliff is imaginary. Biology does not know cliffs.
So where did the fertility cliff myth come from? David Dunson has a theory.
If you write an article on fertility cliffs, then a lot of people are going to read it.
Also, some studies just aren't well done, and there's just not the money provided to do the science properly.
Pregnancy issues, fertility, the funding would be a tiny, tiny fraction of the funding that's available to study cancer or AIDS research or cardiovascular disease. I've been working on it less, partly because there's not the funding.
It's a shame that something so fundamental, literally a matter of life, to a growing number of older parents is not deemed a priority to study. Yes, as you approach 40, you won't have the fertility of an 18-year-old, but for most of us in our 30s, it's not a fertility cliff we're tumbling over. It's more of a slide, and in your later 30s at least, a gentle one. A final few encouraging words.
My name's Lorna. I'm 39, and this is Livia. She's 5 months.
Hi, I'm Linica. I'm 37 years old, and this is my son, Nevin.
I'm Charlotte. I'm 39. That's my baby, Elisa, who was born 3 months ago.
I'm Marnie Chesterton. This production is part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
You're never too old to be young. You're never too old to be young. When you start to lose your figure and your hips keep getting bigger, your chest may slip, but don't you fret. No matter how weak your knees may get, you're never too old to be young.
I admit I'm a lover of the sea and its inhabitants, so I was recalling how it's the male seahorse that carries its young, but I'm not clear if there's a fertility cliff here. And I forgot about the nurture that occurs after the nature.
Male pregnancies. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is Science Update. In a role reversal, male seahorses carry the babies, but they do much more than that. University of Sydney evolutionary biologist Camilla Whittington reveals in the journal Molecular Biology and Evolution that male seahorses have as large a role in nurturing embryos as human moms do.
The female seahorse, she just gives him her eggs that are unfertilized. She pops them into his pouch, and as she does that, he fertilizes those eggs, and he's the one who does everything after that.
The team looked at how gene expression changed in the males during pregnancy. Genes for providing nutrients, regulating oxygen, removing waste, and protecting from infection were all turned on in pregnant male seahorses, similar to gene changes in pregnant women. The research reveals how pregnancy evolved similarly in very different species, and even genders. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.
And authorities at the world's busiest airport say 4 lactation pods are available for nursing mothers as they travel. Officials say the pods at Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport can be locked from the inside and provide bench seating, a small diaper changing table, and an electric outlet for pumps. The stations are inside security checkpoints. And airport officials say construction will be in the works for a pre-security nursing room. Aviation General Manager Miguel Southwell said the airport found there was a real need for these pods. Atlanta follows a nationwide trend. Within the past couple of years, governors in California and Illinois signed laws requiring major airports in their states to have private rooms for nursing mothers. Intimate partner violence, or IPV, has become a prevalent healthcare issue. Instances of assault, battery, rape, stalking, and emotional abuse in relationships can be difficult for nurses to handle, as they often lack the appropriate training to feel confident enough to screen patients for IPV. Well, there's a new training program developed in the Sinclair School of Nursing at the University of Missouri, and it provides a tool to better equip nurses in assisting victims of IPV. It's the first program in the U.S. to implement such a simulation in its undergraduate program, and the results from the program indicate it could be a national model for training nurses. I spoke with Dr. Leah Wood, who developed the simulation program, about how it came to be.
I think it is a huge epidemic in our country, but it's something that makes people uncomfortable, so we don't like to discuss it. And as a nurse, I deal with patients on a very intimate level, and I have that opportunity to build trust with them and really be able to help them through those difficult situations. When I was in my doctorate program, we had to do a project on something that we found to be a problem in healthcare. And as a nurse, part of our admission history is supposed to be asking about intimate partner violence and elder abuse, as well as substance abuse and items like that. What I noticed is the questions that we were supposed to screen for didn't give us a lot of opportunity to ask them or phrase them in an appropriate way. It just had us check a box, is the patient abused, yes or no? And what I noticed is different providers would ask questions like, oh, you don't look abused, or just skip the question altogether because they weren't sure how to ask it and make a judgment call for themselves. And so I began investigating what is the appropriate way to screen for intimate partner violence. And what I found was there is no gold standard. Some say screen women when they come into the ER with visible signs of being abused, such as a broken arm or bruises. Other organizations say you should screen women at every well person visit. Very few make a recommendation on if men should be screened. And if an organization does make a recommendation on who and how often, there's no gold standard on what questions ask, what tools. And so as I began my investigation looking further into this, there was inconsistencies between the organizations themselves, and there were inconsistencies on what screening tool is the best. Should it be a verbal questionnaire? Should it be handwritten? And the CDC actually has a wonderful reference of all the different types of screening tools that are out there and compares them and gives a little bit of statistics, but there's no recommendation on which one is the best screening tool. Part of the issue with what screening techniques are the best is that it's very difficult to collect data showing validity and reliability on a screening tool because there's no way to guarantee when you screen, is this patient really abused, are they not?
So let's talk specifically about what you developed. You talked about different things out there. I'm assuming you thought there has to be a better way.
Exactly. So I looked at all the resources. I did lots of research and I thought there has to be a better way to make a consistent tool for providers to use. And so through my research, I decided the WAS tool was the most comprehensive. And I am of the firm belief, because of the prevalence of intimate partner violence, that every patient should be screened at every visit. If we ask a patient, do you smoke or do drugs? I think that is a perfect time to also be asking about a potential abuse. And so what I wanted to do with my program is kind of create the gold standard in here's what we can use to screen. Even though everyone in the healthcare industry agrees intimate partner violence is a problem and we would like to do something to fix it, very few providers actually screen for intimate partner violence. Research indicates as little as 12% of patients are screened for intimate partner violence. And that is because providers themselves are uncomfortable with the topic. They don't know when to ask, who to ask. They don't know what questions to ask. And they're not sure, heaven forbid, the patient does say yes, what do they do from there? And all of these are barriers that prevented providers from screening for intimate partner violence. So the goal of my program was to give them all of this information so that we can overcome those barriers. So in my program, it's a two-part program. There is a theoretical didactic portion, which discusses the epidemiology of intimate partner violence. It discusses the screening tools, and it discusses who to screen, when to screen, and all of that kind of background knowledge. The second part of my program is an immersive experiential portion through simulation. And that part of the program, the learners are actually getting a chance to conduct an intimate partner violence screening on a standardized patient. So we've given them the tools and the resources of what to ask, and now we're giving them an opportunity to practice asking the questions in a way that feels comfortable to them. And our hope is that by allowing them the chance to practice in a safe, controlled environment, it will build their confidence and they will feel more ready to conduct the screening in a real setting.
Leah, what did you find was the biggest obstacle in terms of having the patient trust the healthcare provider, and what does your program do to address this?
That's a great question. So nurses are the number one trusted profession. It's one of the unique things about our profession. We really get that chance to build trust with a patient, but that trust just doesn't happen overnight. It takes ongoing encounters. And so what we're really hoping with the program is not necessarily that we're able to solve the problem right then and there. It's that we've at least opened the doors to communication for the patient. Most patients want the provider to ask them about abuse. And so through this program, we are just starting that conversation. There's nothing required on the part of the patient. We just want to let them know that we are concerned for them. We are there. We want the screenings to be routine. And by making it a routine part of the conversation, the patient hopefully at some point will come forward if they feel that they need help.
So how is your program different from all the others out there, the simulation, right?
So part of my investigation was to look into training programs, and there are other intimate partner violence training programs, and I looked into successful qualities of them. And the ones that seem to be successful are the ones that revisited the information and gave situational experiences. But those were all hypothetical situations. What is different about our training program is the immersive part of simulation, where the learner actually gets to conduct a screening, and then we do a post-conference in which the standardized patient and the provider asking the question get to discuss, you know, what things did you say that made you feel comfortable? What things made you feel uncomfortable? How would you change it? And the provider gets to also ask questions that maybe they were too afraid to ask during the actual simulation. So maybe about children. I wanted to ask you, are your children in danger? But I didn't know how to phrase it. What could I have said to you? And then they get some feedback from that standardized patient. So it's kind of a nice dialogue. And I think that's what makes our program unique, is there's the dialogue between the patient and the provider asking, how can I improve this to become a better screener?
You mentioned men earlier, as in men being abused.
The prevalence of men being abused is actually about 1 in every 17. And most men, because of the stigma, are afraid to come forward. And so what I'm hoping with this training program, if we make intimate partner violence screenings part of the conversation, part of the routine history, it kind of makes the stigma go away and hopefully will make patients feel more comfortable talking about their problem and asking for resources for help.
What types of questions are part of your program?
Okay, so and actually for our training program, I've developed an intimate partner violence screening interview guide, and it kind of helps the provider have a script almost in case they get flustered and they don't know what to say. So we kind of coach them into raising the subject that now I'm going to ask you a few questions that I ask all of my patients. We have them provide privacy. So these questions are of a personal nature. Would everyone please step out of the room for a moment? I'll let you know when you can come back in. And then asking permission of the patient. Is it all right if we begin? And some of the questions that they may ask is, in general, how would you describe your relationship? Do arguments ever result in you feeling down or bad about yourself? Do arguments ever result in hitting, kicking, or punching? Do you ever feel frightened by what your partner says or does? Has your partner ever abused you physically? And has your partner ever abused you emotionally? So, and part of the program is then to discuss how to handle if they do say an answer that screens positive. So expressing gratitude to the patient, thank you for answering my questions, and then providing feedback and empathizing with them. So I heard you say that you feel frightened by your partner. Would you be willing to tell me a little bit more? Or I'm sorry that you have experienced, you know, physical abuse. No one deserves to be treated like that. And then offering them support, like, is there anything I can do for you at this time? Or here are some resources of, you know, local or national resources that they can reach out to. We also discuss making safety plans.
What is your hope for expanding your program?
My hope for expanding my program is to have it reach out to not just the educational setting, but also into the hospital clinic setting. I think that this program is very easy to adapt to any clinic setting. As far as standardized patients, it could be role-playing between different employees, and then you build empathy for the patient as well. So what I really want to say is that this intimate partner violence training program can be adopted by a variety of institutions, and I really hope to see it being used for medical school, for nurses, for doctors, for respiratory therapists, anyone who has an opportunity to come in contact with a patient and develop that relationship of trust and possibly get someone the help that they need.
That was Dr. Leah Wood, Director of Simulation and Assistant Teaching Professor of Nursing at Sinclair School of Nursing at the University of Missouri. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. The show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1395.